So our passage is in 1 Corinthians chapter 6, and we're going to begin reading it at verse 12 together and finish at verse 20. So the Apostle Paul, and this is part of our regular series that we've been doing, the Apostle Paul writes this to a troubled church. He writes, "All things are lawful to me, for me, but not all things are helpful. All things are lawful for me, but I will not be enslaved by anything. Food is meant for the stomach, and the stomach for food, and God will destroy both, one and the other. The body is not meant for sexual immorality, but for the Lord, and the Lord for the body. And God raised the Lord, and will also raise us up by his power. Do you not know that your bodies are members of Christ? Shall I then take the members of Christ and make them members of a prostitute? Never. Or do you not know that he who is joined to a prostitute becomes one body with her? For, as it is written, the two will become one flesh. But he who is joined to the Lord becomes one spirit with him. Flee from sexual immorality. Every other sin a person commits is outside the body, but the sexually immoral person sins against his own body. Or do you not know that your body is a temple of the Holy Spirit within you, whom you have from God? You are not your own, for you were bought with a price. So glorify God in your body." You are not your own. You were bought with a price. So glorify God in your body. That will become somewhat of a hinge pin verse for us this morning as we consider what this passage is about. This passage is asking us to think about our physical bodies this morning, and whether what we do with our physical bodies, particularly as it relates to sex, if that matters to God. Does what we do physically with our bodies, does that matter to God? But before we consider this, it's worth noting that many of us bring inherited beliefs about sex that grew out of a generation of sexual liberty and revolution to the table this morning. We come preloaded to the text. We have assumptions in our minds. And I'm no different. My own cultural voices, when I was growing up, fed me beliefs about sex and what I should be doing with my body and who I should be doing it with. Like many of you, I grew up with the cultural assumption that sex is everything. You have to have it. It's where you locate your identity. And if you're not having sex, you're missing out on a fulfilled and fruitful life. There's something wrong with you if you're not having sex. Those are the cultural voices, the assumptions that I grew up with. Those are the voices and cultural conditioning that I bring to the table when I look at a passage like this. And perhaps if you were a teenager like I was in the 90s, you grew up hearing this message reinforced to you, and you still do today, over and over again on the radio. I grew up with songs, don't judge me for this, but I grew up with songs that had lyrics like this. It's one band sang this. "Come a little closer, baby. Get it on. 'Cause tonight is the night when two become one. I need some love like I never needed love before. Wanna make love to you, baby. I had a little now, a love, and now I'm back for more. Wanna make love to you, baby. Set your spirit free. It's the only way to be." That comes from a girl band. Don't judge me for quoting those verses. It just came to mind as I was thinking about this passage, you know, and the cultural assumptions that we bring to the table. I could quote hundreds of other songs that would say no different about sex, that you ought to be having it. And you ought to be having plenty of it in order to set your spirit free. It's the highest and the most noblest of things that you can do with your body. So I'm just trying to make the point that we bring things to the table, some deeply rooted beliefs or assumptions about sex, including the assumption that in order to be free and liberated as a human being, you have to experience sex as often as possible and with whoever possible. But the scriptures will challenge this kind of assumption that we bring to the table. The scriptures will challenge our cultural voices. For one, Jesus never had sex. Think about that. Jesus never had sex. And he lived a fulfilled life. All that the Lord had purposed for him to do. So think about that. What it means to be human. And what it means to have liberty and true freedom. Does it have to involve sex? But the scriptures, our particular scriptures, will challenge our assumptions in a different kind of way. And if you're willing to just consider your cultural assumptions for a moment and then consider what this passage has for us, perhaps the Lord has something to teach us this morning. And I'd like us to think about that together. The first thing this passage does for us is to make the point that our bodies are not simply physical shells that we get to do whatever we please with. Rather, our bodies were made to belong to the Lord. It makes this point by showing two things. When they are correctly paired together, they find fulfillment and enjoyment. And you look at this in verse 13, which shows this to us. It says that an ordinary pairing that Paul begins with. Food is meant for the stomach, and the stomach for food. That is a pairing of two things. Food and the stomach. And that's a pretty easy and basic pairing to follow. When you eat food, your stomach is satisfied. That's right, one belongs to the other for fulfillment and enjoyment. Now, some people in this Corinthian church were thinking about this pairing of things, and they thought about sex and the body in the same way as people think about food and the stomach. They were thinking that sex is to the body what food is to the stomach, and that if you restrain your sexual desires in any way, you are starving yourself from true enjoyment and fulfillment. And with that view in mind, there were some people in the Corinthian church who would go to prostitutes to get their fill of sex. They just thought there shouldn't be any restraint, any boundaries. Like food for the stomach, that's how they will treat sex. They will just consume so that their bodily desires would be satisfied. But this, Paul said, was a mistake. To extract sex from the covenant of marriage and to indulge it whenever with whomever is immoral. That is so because in the Bible's view of things, our bodies are not meant to find their greatest expression of fulfillment and joy in willy-nilly sexual encounters. Our bodies are meant to find their greatest fulfillment and joy as our bodies, as a whole, spirit and flesh, as that whole entity relates to Jesus. That is the pairing for which your body was made. The body, the text says, is not meant for sexual immorality, but for the Lord, and the Lord for the body. That is the pairing. The body for the Lord, and the Lord for the body. That is the correct pairing that we are supposed to receive as truth. Now, the way in which the body is meant for the Lord, I mean, that sounds a little strange perhaps to some of us to say that your body, your physical body, is meant for God. It might sound a little strange. So we're going to ask that question. What does it mean to say that the body is for the Lord? It's simply this. By becoming Christian, we become united to Jesus. And Paul makes this point in verse 15. He says, do you not know that your bodies are members of Christ? So he's talking membership. Your physical bodies have become members to the Lord. And Jesus taught this as well, this idea of bodies being members, of belonging to him, of being for him. And Jesus used a cultural analogy of a vine with branches. You guys in the orcharding industry would know this, that it's a vine and there's branches. And Jesus said that he is the true vine, and those who believe in him are like branches. That is our unity with Jesus. The minute you remove the branch from the vine, it'll wither and die. And Jesus is saying that is the kind of unity believers now have with him. A vine and branches. We are connected with him. We are connected with him, and we need him the way a branch needs a vine. And so this unity with Jesus is a profound and real union. It's not just make-believe. It is a real and true union that we have with him. Without it, we're not actually Christians. That is the point being made. There is no such thing as a living branch that's not attached to a vine, right? So without this connection to Jesus, we're just not Christian people. And that's why Paul is so utterly eager to protect that unity with Jesus from pollution of immorality. Because immorality threatens the bond we have with Jesus. Incidentally, it is precisely this unity that we have with Jesus that forms the basis of all sexual ethics in Christianity. It is for this reason that in Christianity we believe there is such a thing as immorality. Right? Other people might not believe that there is such a thing as sexual immorality, but in Christianity we do, because we believe there is a true and real union with Jesus that can be polluted with sexual immorality. We believe that there is a rightful and a wrongful way to enjoy sex. Because we believe that the body was made for unity with Jesus, and that unity should not be belittled with sex with those who have no such unity with Jesus. As our passage says, do you not know that those who are joined to a prostitute becomes one body with her? Or shall I say, shall we take the members of Christ, our bodies, and make them members of a prostitute? Never. Never. To paraphrase, don't take the real union you have with Jesus as a believer and fornicate it away with someone who doesn't. That's just what we're saying this morning. Don't disrupt the unity you have with Jesus. Now, this forms Paul's second major point for abstaining from sexually immoral behavior. Our relational union as a Christian with Jesus is of such a nature that it is polluted when we enter into a sexually immoral relationship. So we just want to pay attention to that, that Paul is offering a warning to protect our Christian faith and to protect our relationship with Jesus. I know to some that these sexual ethics are going to sound restrictive. I am not a stranger to the barrage of cultural voices that tell us that this is archaic and outdated ways of thinking. I see the same message as you do on television. I hear it from people in the street. I see it on advertising. I hear it on the radio. So I get it. If that's what you're thinking this morning, man, this preacher has just crawled out from under an ancient rock with outdated ideas. I get that. I get why you would feel that way, because almost no cultural voice in our day will say anything agreeable to what we have just said about this passage. We are swimming against the tide if we are to conduct ourselves and believe the kinds of things that the Scriptures calls us to believe and to conduct ourselves according to those truths. We are against the tide in this regard. So I get it. I get it that it's difficult sometimes to swim against the tide this way. I get it that there are virtually no cultural voices that will back us up and say, good job. Good job for believing the truth of the Lord's word and not caving in to the cultural voices around you. So I get if that's what you're feeling this morning. Our cultural voices do pressure us to view sex differently. But I just ask us to consider this text a little bit more fully, just to consider it a little further as we continue thinking about sexual ethics according to the Scriptures. There is another reason why Christianity insists that Christians ought to adhere to a particular sexual ethic. It's because our gospel insists that you are not your own, for you were bought with a price. You were ransomed. That's what we're saying here. There is a ransom that has been paid for you as a Christian. In the Christian view of things, we will always serve a master. We all worship. You don't get to choose to worship. The only thing you get to choose is what or who you worship. You will all serve a master. The only thing we get to decide is which master we will serve. And because we all serve some kind of master, that master will always steer our affections of our hearts. And whatever steers the affections of our hearts will steer and govern our behavior. But make no mistake, we will all be servant to something or someone. And in this sense, Christianity says that true freedom is not found in the absence of masters or things to worship. It is finding the right master. Finding the right master to serve and to worship. And that right master is God, the God we meet in the Bible. He is the one who liberates and rescues us from all other masters. As such, the Christian life is precisely one of living out of gratitude to God, our master, who has secured this freedom for us. And we get this picture of liberation and freedom from the apostles' words that you are not your own. You were bought. You were purchased. An offering was made for you to secure your freedom. You were bought with a price. It costs something to free you. You know, to illustrate this, I think many of us would have heard the story of Abraham Lincoln, who had visited a slave market to purchase a female slave in order to free her. It's a common story that many may have heard. And as the story is retold, the slave girl was baffled that this white man, Abraham Lincoln, in the 1860s, would come along and buy her only to set her free, not to further enslave her, but would buy her to set her free. She was baffled. She could go where she wants. She could go live where she wanted. She could be totally free with no master lording it over her. And as the story is retold, she is so baffled by this kind of freedom, an uncommon freedom, that she decided that she would spend her freedom attached to Abraham Lincoln. She would follow him. She wanted to do life with the person that purchased her freedom. And then, I don't know the full factual data of that story, but it does illustrate what the Christian life is like. That God purchased our freedom, and our Christian life is one where we want to spend our freedom with the one who purchased that freedom for us. It's a life of gratitude for purchasing us with a price. We're free in so many ways. You know, God has freed us from the slavery of sin and from condemnation and trying to prove ourselves to God, and from the enslavement of sexual immorality. And the Christian life is one where we cherish that freedom, that we desire to spend our freedom with the one who obtained it for us, Jesus Christ. And all this is to say that our bodies and totality of being, sexual desires and all, is no longer our own. We belong completely to God. He purchased us through Christ, freeing us from the slavery of sexual malpractice. That is the kind of freedom we have. That we are free to wait, or free to abstain if the Lord would call us to singleness all our lives. That is our freedom. For now, I think we could just answer one more question we might have about this passage. Given that it's true that both married and unmarried people have sexual appetites and desires and impulses, what are we supposed to do with them if the Bible puts immorality off limits? What are we supposed to do with these desires that stir within us? What guideline or principle will help govern or direct our sexuality? One guideline or principle Paul will help us to think about is about the wonderful expression of sexual appetite and desire within the context of marriage. And we'll look at that more closely next week. So if you want to hear some more about the beauty of sex within the covenant of marriage, that is next week. But for now, Paul is dealing with churchgoers who are engaging in rampant immorality and visiting prostitutes to get their fill. What guideline, what principle will he offer them that will steady the ship of their affections and desires for sex? Here is the principle by which to govern and direct our impulses. Glorify God in your body. Glorify God in your body. that's Paul's conclusion for those who are visiting prostitutes. He just says the alternative for you is to glorify God in your body. Glorify God in your body. Think deeply about this conclusion. There are other things Paul could have said. He could have said, stop visiting prostitutes. Stop being immoral. Stop having sex outside the covenant of marriage. And those are all true and right conclusions to draw, but that is not the way that Paul talks. He is giving an essentially positive command, not a negative one. He is not giving us more prohibitions, more do's and don'ts for the Christian life. He is opening up more opportunities for liberty and for expressing your freedom as a Christian who has been bought with a price. He is not giving you more restrictions. He is giving you more opportunity to worship, to glorify God with your body. It's not a restriction. It is a liberation. It is a freedom. It is an opportunity to glorify God. And yet, it's not terribly specific. It's not terribly specific to say glorify God in your body when you're tempted to be sexually immoral, to click on a website, to download a torrent, to purchase a magazine, to rent a DVD. Whatever it is where your sexual immorality wants to trap you, Paul says to you, glorify God in your body, but it's not terribly specific. So I just want to offer just a little piece of advice that may help you in that dark hour, in that dark minute when you are tempted to be immoral. How should we glorify God in our body? I think essentially what Paul means here is to use your body to conduct yourselves in such a way and to do the kinds of things and activities that reflect or enjoy God who paid your ransom. Do the kinds of things that show that you actually enjoy God more than you enjoy indulging your sex or your sexual desire. That's what Paul means for those who are not in a covenant of marriage. Glorify God in your body. Do something different. Do something countercultural. Use your body to worship, to glorify God. Not to disrupt the union you have with Jesus. And to help us figure out what those kinds of things might be. What is it that we could do to with our bodies that glorify God? You know, I just offer some advice from a much older saint, Saint Augustine. He just said these simple words, and they are so true when we ponder them correctly. He just said, as a guideline, in your Christian life, love God and do what you please. Love God and do what you please. He meant that truly, sincerely, fully. Love God and do what you please. But in that order. In that order. Love God with your heart, with your mind, with your soul, and with all your strength. And let that well of love for God spill over and energize and give life to what you do with your body. Love God and glorify God with your body. As a Christian, you are no longer a slave to the cultural assumptions that sex is the most high and the most greatest of personal freedoms that you can experience. You are no longer a slave to that assumption. It is no longer the epicenter of your identity as a human being. You were made for something greater, to glorify God with your body. In that sense, our highest freedom and identity is found in the reality that we were once slaves to sin, but now through the ransom of Christ, we have been bought for a new master who frees us to glorify him in our bodies.